I was just discussing a important idea of Judaism, of Torah, with regard to the concept of this world and the world to come, the relationship between the two. And one of the verses says about Torah that Orech Yamim Bimina, length of days, are in its right hand, Bismola Osha V'chavod. It's in its left hand are wealth and honor. So let's see if we can understand that analogy. It's a reference to Torah. And obviously, it's an illustration of the fact that you can't take some of the statements, or most of the statements of the rabbis, literally. The person is going to take it literally, it just doesn't make sense, because how can you apply a right hand and a left hand to Torah? So now they're speaking about the Torah as though it has two hands. And then they're saying each hand has a specific benefit attached to it. Length of days in its right hand. In its left hand are wealth and honor. In general, we recognize the fact that the rabbis differentiate among the commandments. They're not all on an equal level, so to speak, in terms of, for want of a better term, in terms of importance or significance. You have to be very careful when you discuss that, because at the same time, a person should not take any commandment lightly, since they're all from God. Nevertheless, it reflects the idea that there's a system over here. And within a system that applies to virtually every aspect of life, there's going to be things that are going to be more foundational. For example, an illustration of this would be that the principle that if there's a conflict between any of the commandments and a person's life, a person's sick, and in order to save your life, you have to violate a commandment. It could be in any area, it could be any commandment. That is, a person has to eat a certain food, which is not kosher. Or the Sabbath. The Sabbath is very, very important. So are you permitted, a person is very sick on Shabbos and has to go to the hospital. Are you permitted to violate the Shabbos? Or no, you're not allowed to violate the Shabbos. And what about your life? So the Torah basically resolves that issue. And the verse that's cited is these are the laws of the Torah, that a person, ashayasa osam, a person shall do them v'chai behem, and live by them. That is to say that plain meaning is the fact that it's an interesting idea, the plain meaning. You have the plain meaning, and then the, so to speak, halachic implication. Many of the verses of the Torah are on different levels. The plain meaning, of course, is that the point is not simply to perform the commandments, but to live by them. That every commandment contains knowledge and ideas, and it's supposed to be incorporated in a person's life. That's one shall live by them. So one shall live by them implies also even more than that this is the lifestyle, that the entire lifestyle should be formulated in accordance with the ideas and the ideals of Torah. But on a halachic level, v'chai v'hem is conveying a different idea. That is to say that the laws were intended to be the source of life, but it shouldn't be the source of death. So that if there's a situation that comes along where the observance of the law in that particular case will cause death, so then you violate the law, you preserve life. So the preservation of life takes precedence over the performance of a particular commandment. However, that is true with regard to the overwhelming majority of commandments, except for three. And that would be killing. You're not allowed to kill somebody to save your own life. Idolatry. You're not allowed to worship an idol, if that should be the case. If someone were to coerce you to worship a certain idol, or they'll kill you. Forced conversion, so to speak. Or the forbidden sexual relations. If someone were to coerce you to be involved in a prohibited sexual relationship on pain of death. In those three cases, you're obligated to sacrifice your life. That's the obligation. I'm just showing that as an illustration that you can't put all the commandments on the same plane in terms of their significance. So therefore, getting back to the point, it's true that you can differentiate among the commandments. However, is that the intention over here? Because here it's speaking about the right hand of Torah, as opposed to the left hand. But within, is that what the point is? Additionally, the idea of the left, wealth and honor, is problematic. To the extent that you're saying that that would seem to be superficially that the Torah is a means for a person to acquire wealth or honor seems to be contrary to Torah. Certainly doesn't seem to be the case. In what sense is the Torah a gateway to wealth? A good distinction is that the Torah contains primary benefits and secondary benefits. And the you have to differentiate between the two. The right hand is a reference to the primary benefits. What is the real objective of the Torah? The essential purpose and objective of the Torah. That's Biyamina, that's the right hand of Torah. Then there's, so to speak, secondary benefits, which is the left hand of Torah. So now, let's see if we can delineate it more specifically. So what would you say then is the ultimate, the primary benefit of the Torah? Which is the terms here are being referred to as length of days. And again, that's even challenging. What do you mean, a long life? Is that what the most important thing? Again, on the surface, it doesn't seem to be the case that everybody keeps the Torah. I don't think you're going to find statistically that Torah observant people have greater longevity than non-Torah observant people. So then you have to, now you're forced, since we're saying it's the primary benefit, and the primary benefit is length of days, to define what that is. Question is also being raised whether these things that we're talking about, the so-called benefits, how do they come about? Do they come about as a reward? That is to say that those who keep the Torah, God gives them the reward, the wealth, the honor, whatever it is. Or no, it's not meant to be taken that way, but rather it's in terms of the natural result. Being suggested that an explanation might be that the Torah provides the main elements that are essential for the good life. And the good life over here is being referred to as length of days. Because it really doesn't make any sense on any level to say that this is the benefit, the longevity. The whole society today is caught up in longevity, which is a nonsensical pursuit. That's a major theme that permeate, you know, nutrition, and they're always looking for the magical pill to just continue life indefinitely, as though, without even questioning, what's the value? That is, people get excited that they just had Bob Hope just celebrate his 100th birthday. So anybody that lives to 100, that automatically, in and of itself, is considered an unbelievable achievement, accomplishment. I'm not saying anything disparaging about Bob Hope. I'm just saying, but that's the way the society reacts. It's an amazing thing. Why? Because he's 100. Because he lived 100 years. As though just longevity per se. Which seems to be irrational. Because if a person is living correctly, all right, so then it's good. It's okay, it's good. But the truth is that in any sense, people have to accept the fact that physical life, as we know it, is limited. Death is inevitable. So that if a person does have longevity, it means so he lived a little bit longer. The Torah would not present some. Most people relate to this on an emotional level, but it's not really. See, longevity, the way it impacts upon a person psychologically, I think it means the ability to deny death. That's what it means for most people. The reason why people pursue this is because there's a fantasy that somehow or other they're going to be immortal in a physical kind of a way. So the inability to accept death is what motivates this thing. People don't think it through. That even, let's assume you're right, let's say all this nutrition and avoidance of all these bad things will lengthen your life. So you're still going to die. So you get another 2 years. All these things are highly overrated. if you go, you study the statistics, it's not going to make that much difference. And if it does, so you'll have another 5 years. So, is that something to get totally excited about? What's all the excitement? The excitement is the ability to maintain the fantasy or the illusion of immortality. That's what people are getting excited about. So why would the Torah be saying something which is not a real value, but just caters to people's fantasies? Thus, it's being suggested that that's not what's meant. The length of days over here is referring to a goodly life. Even though it's using the term length, which implies the quantitative, but really it doesn't mean that, it really means a good life. Okay. So that's the main element. The main element which transforms an ordinary life into a good life would be Torah. Torah gives you a good life. And secondarily, the essential component of Torah which gives you the good life, that has to be identified. What is it about Torah that gives you a good life? Of course, the answer is the system of Torah, which includes the mitzvos, the commandments, the halachas, the laws that we live by, but only to the extent that a person internalizes the wisdom. As the Rambam explained, the whole importance of the mitzvah of mezuzah, for example, that each time a person enters the house, he pauses and reflects upon the idea that's in the mezuzah. That is to say, he reflects upon the existence of God and the concept of loving God and getting closer to God. And this takes him; it awakens him from his slumber. A person gets caught up in all the vanities of the time. So that's the whole purpose, that he enters the house and he pauses and recognizes what the true purpose of a house is. And when he leaves and goes out into the workplace, he reflects. Instead of just getting caught up and following the natural flow of his fantasies, which he associates with immortality, he removes himself from that and directs himself towards the real, that which is truly enduring, that there's nothing that truly endures except the knowledge of the Creator. And that's a mitzvah of mezuzah. Tremendously significant thing. But only if a person reflects on it. A person just goes through the motions and just routinely, perfunctorily walks in and out. Some people have the habit of kissing the mezuzah, but that doesn't cause any reflection of the mind. So the essential benefit of the Torah has to do with conveying to an individual the knowledge that's essential to have a meaningful human existence, because man is different than any other being. And it seems to be that man is a creature that requires knowledge and understanding for their sustenance. And without that, they're not in a state of happiness. If a person were to be in a state of happiness by nature, in a natural way, you really would not need Torah. Why would God reveal to us the Torah? And this is the belief of many people. Just follow your heart. Or, for example, a very famous slogan that people have is that statement of "Let conscience be your guide." And when people say that, that's looked up to as being a very, very lofty thought. And you can't argue with that kind of thing. Let conscience be your guide. But what would you say? Is that really true? Would we accept that? When people can reflect on what they would like to do, what they ought to do, in a different situation, when situations come up, so then people look at it from different things. There's an opportunity to advance, to make some money in a deal. But there's certain shady aspects to it. So a person reflects on it, there's different aspects of the psyche kicks in. There's the desire. There's the desire to succeed, you know, to make something. Greed. There's the consideration of what you need, how important this would be. There's all the justifications that come into the picture of why really, in point of fact, if you look at it in a certain way, then it's really not so bad. Then there's conscience. Then conscience kicks in, and then everybody, you're dealing, you know, within your own mind, there's a lot of different forces over there. Then the conscience is kind of saying, but it's not really right. Then conscience is kicking in. You don't have guilt at this point because you haven't done it. That's what may come in after the fact. Guilt is what happens after the fact. And it can come in surprising ways. They're very often in consideration of something. When you have a desire for something, and you think about it, and you follow the desire, you never anticipate that the morning after you may be smitten. Conscience just comes out of nowhere sometimes. Unanticipated. Uninvited. But that's, for most people, that's the emotion that's the representative of what is correct. So that they're saying, God implanted within me. I don't need a revelation. It's, you know, God implanted the moral law within me. I think that was Kant, the philosopher. The question is conscience in and of itself a barometer to what is true? Conscience, as we know, it happens to be another emotion that exists within the psyche. And there is a subjective element to it. And if you study history, you study societies, you could see that some of the worst atrocities have been committed not necessarily only because of certain aggressive emotions, but because of conscience. For example, the plague that Israel is smitten with, the plague of suicide bombers, who are not motivated by any desire for material advantage, but this is part of it's ingrained into their whole way of religious thinking. It's a conscience phenomenon. Well, let's take another example. That is it proper to stand up and fight against evil? Let's say against Hitler, World War II. So most people would say yes, because he's got to be destroyed. Because he's evil. And if you don't destroy him, all the harm, all the destruction. But there are people that would refuse to fight against Hitler because of conscience. Quakers, pacifists. That's a matter of conscience. Their conscience dictates that killing is wrong under any and all circumstances. So their conscience has become attached to a certain idea. Thus we see that conscience itself is no barometer to what's true. It's just a reflection of how a certain psychological mechanism has set itself up in a particular individual. And it's very much related to the bottom. If you'll analyze it, you'll see it's an idea. It's based on an idea. The idea is all killing is evil. Killing per se. All killing is evil. If that's so you can't say conscience anymore. Now we have to investigate. Is that idea true? The idea upon which your conscience is based, that not killing is good, which makes you feel good, you have a good conscience, or killing no matter what, no matter how evil the object, or no matter what the purpose is. And the purpose would be to prevent the world from being destroyed. I suppose that according, if you can take that position to its logical extreme, that is, if someone, an evil individual, had his hands on the type of nuclear weapons that would destroy the whole world, because that's the theme of a lot of these movies today, very creative. And the only way to prevent it would be to shoot that person. So here's the dilemma, but the person who's the only person with the gun and knows how to shoot happens to be a pacifist. Well, that's why in his youth, before he was a pacifist, he was a wild killer. He used to like murder. That's why he became a pacifist. It's a reaction formation. But that's his conscience. So, if that's the case, we can't kill him. But the end result is not only going to be that you'll be killed, but the whole world will be killed. Now, I think that most people would recognize that that's an absurd position. So therefore, you see that the idea to let conscience be a guide is not necessarily a good thing. But it all depends upon what exactly your conscience is guiding you to do. Could be a good thing if it's in line with the truth. Could be a very horrible thing if it's in line with the false. So then you have to say that what's essential over here is the truth. And the very fact that God revealed the Torah to mankind, which is an objective system of ideas to live by. Of course, God, taking cognizance of the fact that before God gave the Torah, God had given man a conscience, and man had a conscience to live by. And if truth, if the appropriate way, resided in the human conscience, and conscience is to be your guide, so why did God have to give us the Torah? God could have given us the Torah with one commandment: let conscience be your guide. There would have been no need for anything else. While we're on the subject of conscience, it should be pointed out that there is a purpose for conscience. But people make a huge mistake about it. I would say that conscience was implanted in a person to act as a counterforce to the power of the instincts. The instincts in man are extremely powerful. very, very difficult to control. And apparently, understanding enough, for most people, unless people reach a very advanced state, the mind per se is not endowed with sufficient strength to control the instincts. Left to its own. That if people have a conflict, there's something that they instinctually desire, and you just point out with logic that it's not a good thing, then the role that the mind, that understanding and knowledge plays for most people is just insufficient. They're just going to follow their desires. However, conscience is a very powerful emotional force which causes them to stop in their tracks. Because that, too, is a very powerful emotion, which makes a person feel very, very miserable and depressed and sick. So, the guilt factor. Thus, conscience is an emotional counterweight to the force of the instincts. Therefore, I would say that when a person feels, when a person is considering doing a certain thing, and it arouses your conscience, bear in mind the conscience can fool you, too. In line with the point we made before, let conscience be your guide. It's not always, even in your personal life, there are very, very times when you'll feel guilty about doing something where it's unwarranted. Sometimes you have to do something which is difficult. Sometimes you have to discipline a child, and logic dictates that you should discipline the child. But you feel bad about it, and then you do it, and you see the reaction of the child, and then you feel miserable. Just because you feel miserable about it doesn't mean that it's the wrong thing. Contrarily, you'll see that parents in general, when they give in, when they're lenient, they go the other way, so to speak. They overlook something, or they give the child a reward, even though they didn't really deserve it, and whatever it is, and they follow that emotion, then they don't feel so guilty. But even logically, this is just as wrong as the other case. So the way the emotions work are geared towards towards certain feelings within the person. So just because you feel good about something doesn't mean that it's right. And just because you feel bad about something doesn't mean that it's wrong. That's something that can only be determined. Perfected individual feels happy, feels content when they did something, even if they did something which caused the child pain. Sometimes you have to cause the child pain. David HaMelech, King David, is criticized with regard when it mentions that his son Adoniyahu tried to seize the kingship when David was old. He tried to seize the kingship, and David really had intended to appoint Solomon. That's one of the last major episodes in the life of David. And the pasuk points out in an interesting way. Below Atsavo, Aviv, Miyamov. And his father, meaning Adoniyahu's father, meaning David, Atsavo had never caused him to be upset in his life. That's the way it expressed it. Never caused, that means he never chastised him. Never did anything which would cause him to be upset. That's a perfect illustration, because that's what really bothers the parent. The parent is really bothered if they did something and the kid gets very upset. Yeah, but the question is, maybe that's really good. Maybe that's really good. You feel bad about doing it. That's your problem. You're identifying with the pain. It's your emotions and so on and so forth. It would be the same as a doctor who performs a very successful surgery, removing some type of cancer and saving a patient from dying, and then you visit the patient. The patient's excruciating pain, which is just pretty much just recuperating from the surgery, and the pain's going to go away, and the doctor's not going to feel guilty. The doctor will feel very, very happy because his mind tells him that this is really good. Thus, you can't rely on conscience alone to dictate your behaviors. If you do so, you're going to make tremendous mistakes. Because it's not the conscience is not necessarily in line with the truth. Now, the more truth a person gets, then the conscience is going to adjust to the truth. The conscience will keep adjusting, so that your conscience will be a better barometer. But it never can be the ultimate arbiter. The ultimate arbiter will always have to be knowledge. But I think this is the role. The analogy I would give is as follows. What do you do when you feel a pang of conscience? When you're contemplating doing something, or you have already done something, and you feel that feeling. You've just had a conversation with a friend in which you pointed out you had some issues, some complaints, and you pointed it out to the person. You rebuke the person. And now you feel bad after the fact. Now, very often a person, because they feel bad, they'll just act on the feeling and call back and start to apologize. But that's, now, my opinion is, I would say that the relationship of the conscience to the conduct of a person, that conscience in the role of the psyche plays the same role as pain in the role of the physical. That it's the will of God that a person should feel pain. The pain is really a good thing, as everybody knows. If somehow or other somebody could give you a pill that would shut down the mechanism of pain, that would be a very bad thing, because that pain is a warning signal. A person experiences certain types of pains. The smart thing to do is to investigate them, find out what it is. Sometimes it's nothing. Sometimes it's significant. It could be an indication. It's an early warning system that God implanted within the physical structure of the person, an early warning system. So you heed the warning system. But just as soon as you get a pain, you don't start going crazy that I'm dying or whatever it is. That's absurd. You don't know what it is. Unless you're an expert, you go to the doctors. Today they have sophisticated testing. You find that it could be that you had a pain. When you had that pain, you thought it's over. Your whole life is over. And then it turns out that that's very possible. That is a simple kind of thing. And here's the treatment. And 2 days later, you'll forget you ever had the pain. So therefore, a wise person does not make a decision on the basis of a feeling of pain. But you do make a decision that it has to be investigated to find out what the truth is, where it's coming from. The same thing would be with the feelings of conscience, the pangs of conscience that hit you in the psyche. It's an early warning system. It's a warning system. It could be because it is connected, because that part of the psyche is connected towards the aspect of doing things that maybe towards the right and wrong factor in the psyche. It has to do with the right and wrong. But that right and wrong, that's what you feel is right and wrong. It doesn't mean that it's objectively so. So what do? If you're feeling guilty about something, I mean, it's something that's bothering you about it, but then you go to the doctor. No, not the guy that's covered by your the HMO or that kind of thing. Then you go to the doctors of the soul. Then you go to someone with knowledge of these matters and inquire, is there anything objectively wrong? That would be a good utilization. But to simply base your decision, you got to be very, very careful about that. If you're feeling a feeling of conscience, that could indicate that there could be something wrong. Because there's a reason. And then you'll start to explain. It could be very often that it's nothing. There's no reason for it. Because let's say we'll get back to the simple case of having to discipline someone. A child, whatever it is. So you're feeling really bad about that. Well, then you have to analyze. Maybe you feel bad because you're not really doing it for objective reasons. Maybe it's your personal ego is involved, and you're angry at the child for your personal reason, and it's not really objectively correct. In which case, then there is an aspect. The guilt is coming from that. That could be. So then it's good that you analyze it, and upon analyzing it, you discover what the real motivation is. Or it could be that may be your emotion. It's true, you may feel guilty for that reason, because at the same time, it may be gratifying certain emotions of yours, but the course that you've chosen is a correct course. That's the role of the conscience. You shouldn't ignore it, but it should be an indicator that there's something here that should be investigated. Getting back to the statement, length of days in its right hand, its wealth, the left hand is wealth and honor. The left hand is a little bit troubling because honor certainly does not seem to be a thing that the Torah promotes as a value. To the contrary, there are many statements. Interestingly enough, in Pirkei Avos it says, whoever runs after honor runs away from him. The point is very strong that the Torah is not advocating honor. All of our great people are people that were not interested in honor, and we look at it as a defect. That's tied up with ego, promotion of the ego. And the Rambam points out the one of two of the dispositions that a person should go to the extreme. Generally, he says you shouldn't go to either extreme of abstinence or overindulgence, but moderation, so to speak, in the middle. But when it comes to humbleness, for example, humbleness is a person who goes to the extreme side. Because that's the greatest defect. The greatest defect is a lack of humility, egotism. That's the ultimate destroyer. In terms of the real good of life, the obtainment of wisdom, perfection. Now, honor seems to be associated with that. People that seek honor basically have a defect. Not to mention another very strong question that was posed was that the wealth. Again, the Torah doesn't promote wealth, per se. To the contrary, it seems to be tied up with the materialistic value system. You speak about wealth. Moreover, ordinary observation would seem to indicate that you don't see that the Torah scholars in general are wealthy people. So many of them are very poor. That's a practical kind of a question. It's true. It's a different kind of question because we're just studying the idea. And when we study the idea, we're not asking those kinds of questions. How come so-and-so? How come that one? But still in all, I think it's a valid point on two bases, that the Torah does not present itself as being a guide to wealth, how to achieve wealth, physical wealth. And we don't see any tradition amongst the rabbis that they necessarily were the wealthy class. To the contrary, there is a statement of the Talmud which says that you should be very careful about your treatment of the poor. Because in Hebrew, may Aniye Yisrael Yotzei Torah. From the poor of Israel will come forth the Torah. That's saying a different concept. Interesting, in our framework, in our society, most societies kind of don't look up to the poor. They look down and they may have some pity on the poor. Everyone always talks about the poor. But in a condescending, you know, patronizing kind of way, because basically they regard them as being in an inferior state, the poor. People won't admit that. But Judaism is saying something different, that from the poor of Israel, that class, that strata of society, comes forth the Torah scholars. Which, the reason being, that it doesn't have to be this way. You can't take these statements as absolutes. The reason being, you have to understand human psychology. That people who are raised in the midst of wealth and opportunity and plenty, they tend to just follow all these fantasies and they don't have that motivation. They don't have that energetic drive to pursue truth and wisdom and knowledge. But people that have nothing else in this world, that really can't indulge the physical and the material, so they have to have something that makes life meaningful. So they don't turn to Torah necessarily for idealistic reasons, but they're forced to turn to Torah, and they put all their energy into Torah, and then they emerge as great Torah scholars. They're freed from these distractions. You yourself see that the more you're surrounded by indulgences and distractions and games and movies and this event, the other event, so there's no need. You don't have that energy. To the contrary, sometimes you're alone and you have nothing else to do, whatever, you can pick up a book and get immersed in the book. Simply because you have nothing else to do. But once you're involved in it, then you recognize, hey, this is great. Why don't I do this more often? This is much more fun than all these other things I'm doing, wasting my time till I got there and it's waiting online to get in and it's too loud and noisy and I didn't really enjoy it that much and now I have to get home after the ball game and the traffic. What did I get? I could have sat home and read a book. Good point is being made in terms of honor. Of course, it's been said that people, Torah scholars, people who live according to these values, don't pursue honor. And it doesn't seem like they receive the honor. However, it's not as simple as it looks. We find in the Torah, for example, that when Jacob died, he received unbelievable, tremendous honor from the entire Egyptian society. They all mourned for him for many, many days, and they accompanied his body back to be buried in the cave of the Machpelah. It's an interesting thing that you see in our time today that people, it's true that people honor different kinds of people that we necessarily wouldn't honor. But take an individual like Einstein. Einstein's received tremendous honor by the world. There's no question that he received tremendous honor. So there is something in people, even though they didn't understand what he was talking about, or his ideas, or couldn't identify with his way of life, essentially the life of the mind, the life of knowledge. Still in all, there's something in the average person that recognizes that this is an element of greatness. In a sense, the honor that they give to an Einstein, even though, in terms of public manifestation, the person shouldn't have any value for honor of people, recognition, as far as recognition, because take a look at who's being recognized in our society today. You know, the baseball players, movie stars, etc., all this recognition and honor, so then obviously it can't be worth much, because it's not based upon anything of real value. Still in all, people do have a reality principle within them which enables them to recognize that the mind is the person. And when they see an Einstein, and even they know about his mental exploits, that he's the one that discovered atomic power and so forth or whatever, there is a tremendous respect. So in that sense, a genuine person of truth is subject to a certain type of honor. However, while it's true, I don't know that this exactly is what it's the most significant point that it is referring to over here. So I'd like to see if I can explain the point on the basis of everything that we've worked out together over here. Because it's making a very major statement about Torah. Talking about the totality of Torah. This is what Torah is, this is what Torah does. So it's an important foundation. Now I think everybody was correct that Yamina, the right hand, is a reference to the essential. The essential objective. The essential achievement. The primary. And the primary is referred to, interestingly enough, a bit euphemistically, as length of days. Now the Rambam, when he talks about the ultimate good, the ultimate benefit of Torah, or if we'll use the term reward, here in the sense, gain, the ultimate achievement, he says, is eternal life, the life of the world to come. A person who perfects himself in accordance with Torah lives eternally. And he describes the world to come. He says we can't envision it because it doesn't pertain to the situation, the psychic situation that we're in right now, so it's something we really can't imagine. We know about it because the Torah chose to reveal it to us. And there are two aspects by which it is to be understood, two aspects of it. And one is that it's eternal. Now, how does the Torah doesn't speak about, it's interesting, the Torah does not speak about paradise. The Torah nowhere tells you to keep the commandments, you'll live forever. The Torah does not promote, it doesn't use the paradise card. Even though the truth of the matter is that the phenomenon is there. That's what the Rambam is saying. Where does the Torah allude to it? The Torah alludes to it in conjunction with a particular mitzvah. It's called the Shiluach HaKan, the sending away of the birds. That is, a person comes upon a mother bird with the two chicks. So you're not allowed to take the chicks in the presence of the mother. And it says, send away the mother, and then take the chicks. So as the Ramban explains, it's designed to inculcate, it's amazing, the amount of sensitivity, a certain sensitivity to compassion, to prevent the mother from experiencing that pain. Then it says you shall do this. L'man yitav loch. In order that it be good for you, v'harachta yamim. And you'll extend your days. That's the plain meaning. Here again, we're talking about the plain meaning of the text, is that you should do this command, which indicates a very high degree of sensitivity. In order that it be good for you, and you'll extend your days. So, that's talking about in this world. But, it's an allusion to the world to come. Because, v'harachta yamim, you'll extend your days, the rabbis interpret this to mean, in a world which is completely extended. That is to say, eternal. So the code word, length of days, the code word is eternal. That's one aspect. See, one aspect of the world to come is that it is eternal. It's an amazing thing. That is to say that God is the source of all existence. God gives us existence. And the kind of existence that God made available to us is eternal existence. That's really, if it's real, then it's eternal. The other aspect is, l'man yitav loch, that it'll be good for you. Which is in a world that is completely good. L'olam shekulo tov, a world that is completely good, which is to say that in this world we can experience the good, but we can't experience it in a state of perfection, because any good that we experience in this world is intermingled with a lot of pain. So when you talk about good versus a bad thing, it's all relative. It's all relative. When you talk about a good experience, if I had analyzed even the best day of your life, you'd see that even on that day, it wasn't completely. There was anxiety, there was concern, there was worry, but in the end, it worked out great. So you compare, comparatively speaking. But it wasn't totally good, because we're in a physical situation. It's an imperfect situation. We can relate to the good in this world. We can experience the good, but we can't experience it without a certain amount of pain. And the difference with the world to come is that it's the world there is completely good, in the sense that all of the negative factors which prevent us from experiencing the good in its totality are removed. So that's why I'm saying that that is really the essence of the Torah. The essence of the Torah is that it relates to the essential element in man, in the human being, which is the divine soul, the perfection of the soul. That's the essence of man, is that he's a being whose essence is the soul, and it manifests itself in a physical form. That we that's our challenge, to live this existence in a physical form. But the purpose is, there's two purposes, of course. One purpose is to navigate our way through the physical challenges. This is the will of God, is that we should... This is the form in which we have existence. We live in this world, and we have to engage in the tasks that are related to this world. So you're really working on two fronts. You can't ignore. You can't be an ascetic and ignore your task as a physical being in this world. But at the same time, you become totally consumed in this world, so what about my soul? Ah. So then the question is, are these two different arenas? A certain amount of time I'm involved in this world, I'm functioning as a physical being, then I get out of that and I... Well, no, the Torah is a system which is designed to enable you to live the correct kind of life in terms of your physical existence in this world. And as a result of being involved in that process, it's perfecting and refining the soul, so that automatically the soul is being perfected, and when a person's physical life is over, the soul merits the world to come because of the perfection that it it's a natural process. It's a natural process. That's the right hand and the left hand going together. So that is to say that it's not, as many people envision, that in this world, you're religious, you know, you just make a sacrifice, you do all these painful things, and you get rewarded in the next world. That's not our view. Our view is that it's a system of perfection, which is first and foremost geared towards living correctly the life in this world. But that's the left hand of Torah, interestingly enough. At the same time, by following the Torah, you're perfecting. Every mitzvah involves you in a certain perfection, removes you from a certain defect, from a certain excess, from a certain bad character trait, and redirects you towards the proper path. So you're perfecting your soul. When you're performing a mitzvah, you're gaining two benefits. The essential benefit is you're perfecting the soul. Insofar as you're removing it from the attraction to that which is false, to that which is illusion, to that which is not real, and the good is that which is real. You're removing yourself from that, redirecting yourself towards the truth. That's the primary benefit. Insofar as you're doing it, you're doing that, and you're a better person, an improved person, you're improved for life in this world as well. It's left hand. The secondary benefit is you'll have the best possible life in this world as well. This is the best way to live. That's what Rav Moskowitz challenged you with. I'll prove to you it's the best way to live in this world. That is to say, as a result of achieving these character traits, as a result of moderation, as a result of the fact that you don't overestimate the physical benefits and you don't live fantasy, you're geared towards achieving the real good, so then you'll achieve wealth and honor. Wealth and honor. Wealth and honor not as it's understood, misunderstood, let's put it that way. By wealth, we're not talking about becoming a millionaire or a billionaire. The Torah speaks about wealth. Who is wealthy? One who's satisfied with his portion. It means an intelligent type of a situation that you'll have since you're geared, since you have an intelligent understanding of the role of the material, the role of the physical, you can organize your life in such a way, and since you're the kind of person who's disciplined, who's intelligent, who has control over his emotions, you will be much more effective in establishing, and I'm not even talking about the phenomenon of divine assistance, we'll leave that out, although there is such a thing. Doesn't mean as a reward God will set up a situation for you. There is an element of divine providence, but even without that, even without the element of divine providence, and in a purely naturalistic way, a person that's living, that has internalized the real values and character traits, and has the real goals, the real appreciation of learning and wisdom, that person will achieve wealth. But the wealth really means that the wealth means a situation in which you'll have what your needs are. Because wealth can't be measured objectively. Is it a million? If you're a millionaire, then it's 10 million. If you have 10 million, then it's 100 million. If you have 100 million, it's a billion. What's wealth? That's not the wealth we're talking about. The wealth is a situation in which a person has his needs in comfort. That is to say, wealth is really the negation of the opposite. It's the negation of being in a state of want. It's having what you need and rejoicing in what you need. That's true wealth. And the same is true with honor. That a person like that doesn't mean... Rifka made an excellent point. True honor. That a person who's perfected in that way is worthy of honor, and that doesn't mean recognition. That person doesn't care about recognition. But it means to say that I would say it's the same thing, that insofar every human being has a certain sense of dignity. Your dignity won't be violated. That's the kavod, the honor, that you'll live in a state where you'll feel good about yourself. And you will not be in a state of being looked down upon or hated or despised. That's the sense of the honor. Whether people will notice it or whether people won't, or whether you'll get an award, the recognition factor, that's not what's being referred to. You'll be in an honorable state. And your need as a human being doesn't need honor. But a human being does have a need not to be degraded. There is an element of human dignity. That's part of every person. That we say that in the grace after meals. At the conclusion of the third blessing, when we pray to God to sustain us, to provide us, and so forth, the Na'al Tashrichenu, we mentioned, and we should not be dependent on other people. Even though there's such a thing as charity, everybody has an obligation to give charity, but the person that's dependent upon is in a diminished state. Because that's the psychic structure of a person, is that even though there's no reason why the person ought to be, because sometimes it's not his fault. There are people that suffer problems in life and they become dependent upon charity. That's not, there's nothing shameful about that, but it's difficult for the person to deal with in terms of his sense of human dignity. That's what I think it really means. With wealth, that if you live correctly in accordance with the values and the perfections that come as a result of following the Torah truthfully, then you will have the best of both worlds. It's the best way to live in this world. If you factor out, if you can see through the falsity of all the vanities, all the illusions, all the goals that people are chasing, but they're elusive, and you have the proper objective. So you'll utilize the benefits of this world as a means to attaining the real good. You'll have the best life in this world. And as a natural result, your soul will be perfected. So that's the ultimate, because this world is temporal. It's temporal, and it's corporal, so it's impossible to attain it in the most perfect form. Existence in the most perfect form is what God is giving us, is what the Torah is promising us. Existence in the most perfect form. But since we have free will, that's the purpose of this life. It's, so to speak, an antechamber towards the world to come. To live correctly in this life, and if you do so, then you'll get the best of what this world has, this life has to offer. And as a natural result, your soul will be perfected, and you'll automatically continue to exist and to relate to the good which you related to in this world, you'll now relate to in the world to come in an eternal fashion without the hindrances that held you back and limited your capacities in this world. That's what I think the statement is saying. It's telling you the ultimate framework, the ultimate objective of what the Torah is all about.